Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on chumbacasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's chumbacasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Sander, we welcome you to 20 years of 24, the podcast. We're celebrating the 20th year anniversary of the successful Global 24 franchise this year. This year marks the 20th year anniversary of the pilot this November. And you played a big character on 24, George Mason. You were the director of CTU, and your relationship with Jack Bauer was very interesting, to say the least. It was very exciting to watch. Currently, I'm binge watching season one with my mom right now off Disney Plus, and you're a major player in season one. So I'd like to, all the fans, myself and Ryan, would love to know, how'd you get started in 24, and what made you want to be involved with 24? And what was your experience like playing George Mason in seasons one and two?
I feel like in full disclosure, first of all, hi, thank you for having me. Nice to be here.
Thank you.
Nice to join the community that is celebrating this 20th anniversary. I have to be honest that in the beginning, it was just a guest star role in the pilot.
Yeah.
And
oh, really?
It wasn't intended to be carried on beyond that. And I was doing a bunch of other things at the time. And it was an offer because I think they wanted me to come in. And I said, come on, this is Ron Howard's company. I'd just done Apollo 13 and I'd worked with Ron as an actor. I said, they know me. If they want me, they can offer it to me. I'm kind of busy. There was a lot of stuff going on. And so they did offer it. And I just took a quick look at it. And the day before, when I went in for my fitting, the day before we started shooting, I'd gotten the character wrong. I thought I was playing a guy who I'm friends with. I can't remember. It'll come to me in a second, but he had the mustache. He was shot.
Richard Walsh, does that sound right?
And I thought he was even more of a prick than I was, so I figured that's the one they wanted me for. Still in that shit heels R us stage of my career, which I can't really say I've had a tremendous redemption, regardless of the opportunity that 24 would have appeared to provide for me to do so. I sacrificed my vanity a little too willingly early on in my career. And I got pigeonholed into shit. Yeah. But I assumed it was going to be that other part. And I thought, okay, so there's... And then actually, they wanted to play George Mason. And there wasn't a lot on the page for George. What can I do to make him more interesting? Just in my head, I was like, yeah, I can do this. And immediately I sort of, even though it wasn't on the page, I saw what would help the show, because you learn, you train yourself to sort of, how can I help tell this story?
Right, right.
And so that's where my gears immediately started when I read the whole episode, the pilot.
Right.
And then I went back in my mind, how could this guy help move the gears or provide a different color in the painting, give it some shape? And I thought gravitas and a dry, ironic, cryptic, a little bit cynical sense of humor. Because she wears something that is most often left out of urgent dramas. Anything that has a suspense element there. I think they're always afraid they're going to derail the urgency and the seriousness of the situation if they incorporate humor.
Right.
And I think exactly the opposite. I feel it's people that do this for a living. By that point, I talked to a lot of people that do this kind of stuff for a living. And I know from being around them, I knew then 20 years ago from being around them that gallows humor was what made what they do possible. It's what got them through one rough day after the next. And yeah.
Telling jokes at a funeral.
Yeah. And when all hell is breaking loose and you know your life is in jeopardy, day after day, or you're up against some monolithic evil or something, what do? You have to diffuse, and you have to, in a certain way, you have to distance that reality in order to make it bearable.
Right.
And so, but it's not a, like, but a bump.
Right. Yes. Humor. Yeah. You weren't. Your George Mason wasn't a jokey character. There was a dry, almost sardonic wit that came through. That was, as you said, cynical. But
and the gravitas helps to balance that.
Right.
So you are serving the story's weight and urgency, but you're also giving the off can. And they let me throw in a few ad libs in the pilot. And that established what we were going to do. And then they wanted me back. They started writing for that. And I wanted to be back because I wanted to do more of that. And, of course, I did meet my future wife on the pilot episode. And I wanted to say,
is there anybody else whose life changed more than yours because of 24? I don't know.
I don't suspect. I mean, Keith was on a roll anyway. He didn't get spin off like we did. Our daughter.
Yeah, the ultimate spin off. Absolutely. Absolutely. Do you mind talking about that? How that, you know, how you met? Like, that is, it was such a, because I remember as a fan, I mean, I have the benefit. Justin came into the game years into the show. I was the one who bought the DVDs. I actually rented the DVDs first, watched two episodes, took them back to the video store, went to Walmart and bought the DVDs because I said, this story is already beyond captivating. So I was watching those. And then to hear your news kind of in the midst, you know, watching season one and season two.
Yeah, that's right. You know, my wife is a nice Midwestern girl, and I don't want to in any way, it was a bit of a delicate balancing, she's more discreet than I am in general.
Sure.
Person, you know, and I grew up in a sort of arty bohemian family, you know, and she did not.
Right.
And, you know, it was almost like I had conned her from the start because I wasn't my scruffy, bedraggled, ho bohemian self at the time. I was very, you know, head of the CTU.
Right, right.
Slick and put together, and
but with an edge.
So she probably wouldn't be with an edge. Which, you know, as we came to find, she had too.
Yes, surprise.
Now, and I will share one thing that, you know, we'll give the context. But on our, I think it was on our first date that we knew just immediately that things were going to be serious between us.
Wow.
And she, I just remember her saying, I just want to warn you, I'm really intense. And I looked back and I went, you have no idea.
Do you know what you're getting into? I mean, we're celebrating 20 years of 24, but you're celebrating 20 years
yes.
in a totally different way, much more significant way.
We've been together since pilot and then, you know, she came up to visit me shortly after when I was doing a job like She was back in New York and came up to visit me in Vancouver, because I got two tickets in my deal. I didn't even know. And we talked about my maybe coming to New York and seeing her when I could. And suddenly she's up there the next week. And so we got to know each other for another week. And then she went back to New York and she had a movie she was doing up in Philadelphia. And I thought, well, I got to wait another couple of weeks to see her. Why don't I just drive across country and go get her? I brought two tickets to Portugal with me, you know, to be romantic about it all. And I'm courting this girl because I knew from the start, and from the conversation we had on the phone, it could have been like she thought, you know, I see. She they gave me two tickets for this gig, and I would, and I was. And she said, "I'll come." And I went, and she goes, "Oh, wait, that's not what you're going to say. What you're going to say?" And I said, "I was thinking of coming to New York, but you want? Have you ever been to Vancouver? You should come to Vancouver because it would be." Wait, let me just see if I have any days off so I know that it's going to be worth your while.
Right, right.
And then it turned out I had a nice 5-day in between different scenes that I had to shoot.
It was meant to be.
It was meant to be. And there's no question about it. And I remember when that I hung up the phone, I just went, I'm done. I was 45. I've never been married. Suddenly, I began to think, am I just never going to feel like this is the right person? And then all of a sudden, all doubt was erased, and it was on. And so we were together that summer. I drove across, and we spent the summer in New York, her apartment, and it happened to be the last summer of my father's life, so I got to be going out on weekends to see them, my parents, and they got to meet my parents. It was the only time my father ever gave the full... perfect.
Wow.
Stuff, you know, and I, you know, one does care. Because he kept saying, I don't know, what's your hurry? And he liked all the girls.
Yeah.
Just never felt like I never did. Certain that's one, and that, and it's just how weird how you care. So it had a destined quality to it from the start. And then what was funny is we drove, I took the northern route there, like through the Black Hills.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah.
A lot of photographs and I actually had, in preparation for playing a spy in case the show got picked up, I got some spy equipment and put in my baseball cap, a little camera, and a pen that recorded.
Yep.
Like, I felt like we're about to lose a lot of our regional accents.
Yeah, right, and right. I wanted to capture that.
I wanted to make a record of them as I went across.
Yeah, yeah.
And I now understand how undercover people get really... a little bit tense at times.
did you get them from a legitimate source or like the ones from the comic books?
Legit.
Because I used to always want the ones from the comic books would always have those ads at the end. I always wanted those.
The x-ray glasses.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Sure. Well, this was more like a camera that I had a ball cap. I thought would help disguise me anyway, because I don't wear ball caps.
Right.
And then
step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of the Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play the Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group, no purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions, 18+.
That it would have the thing, you know, that I would just be, I could never quite get that right, but I did have the beautiful pen recording thing that was really working.
Really worked well. Nice.
Yeah, except the first saloon I walked into in Wyoming, they recognized me from a bunch of shit. And I was like, oh, there goes that. I wanted to pretend I was mysterious.
I'm not a fly on the wall anymore, right?
Yeah. That's the other thing. Like regional accents, that's disappearing. Your anonymity just slowly disappears.
Sure, sure.
So, Isander... you know, 24 or 20 years later is still popular. I mean, it works. It's growing in fan base. It's doing well worldwide ever since it's been on Disney Plus. what do you think? What was the magic about 24 that made it so successful? And do you think, with it being successful, that it could easily be revived in this day and age?
Yeah, well, that's a two-parter, and I'm going to try to loop back to where we were before for a second, just so it doesn't leave a dangling participle. Brain works that way.
Yeah, absolutely.
While we were in New York that summer, we were sent a copy of the pilot, and my feeling was 9/11 had not happened yet,
right?
And there had never been a show that could be sold in syndication that had to be watched in chronological sequence.
Right.
The only way
that piece of machinery functions is if they can shuffle the deck and scatter them around and people catch them as they catch them. And so my gut said, this is cool, but this isn't really commercially viable in that respect. And right. Fox hadn't become a fledged network yet. They were taking chances, but they weren't taking bold chances. They were taking chances to help establish their brand.
Yeah.
And this felt like it was a risk. And I just thought, you know, my experience and why I tended to not commit to TV series back then was because they weren't as edgy as independent and even a lot of the mainstream films that I was doing at the time. And I liked that edgy thing.
Yeah, right.
And I liked that about the show, but I also didn't anticipate it being picked up. And then it was. And so I had a nice Volvo there in the city and pack that thing up, get your stuff in here, and we'll drive back and then we'll take the hillbilly route back. and we did. And we did our own little research. And when we came back to set, we kept it very under wraps that we had boldly gotten together after the pilot. And I remember that this is one good anecdote, and Carlos will appreciate that it's a little bit at his expense because we have such a good laugh about it. He independently went up to both of us and asked like what we'd done over the summer. I went to Portugal and a little while, drove across country, and then, oh, that is so weird. Did you know that Sarah went to Portugal?
What a coincidence.
And we got to talk about that. and somehow we ditched the obvious, like, caught red-handed.
Yeah, and they believed it.
Just that's so weird. That's like a coincidence. And so you guys should really hang out. it was fascinating then the confluence of 9/11, the tragic and fascinating to watch how these things wove together right before the show started to air.
Right.
And then we cut the pilot because it was the planes blowing up, stuff like that. Too much.
Yeah.
And yet it quite simply, and this comes back to both part one and two of your question, it became a zeitgeist phenomenon.
Right.
Because of that, the urgency of the split screen thing. And I'd just done this movie called Time Code where Mike Figgis had done that split screen thing. And Stephen Hopkins being a Brit who saw that movie, I can't help but think he utilized that idea in such an effective and powerful way in the pilot, and that became the motif, and also for me a kind of active symbol of the zeitgeist because it was so timely, and it was a time. It was like a time bomb, and we got caught up watching it the way fans did, and we would go over to friends' houses and knock on the doors and say, "Are you watching tonight?" And we would like darn when the joom joom would happen, and even though we knew what was going to happen, we'd already shot.
Right.
But there was just something so powerful, and it's adrenaline.
The pacing, sort
of,
the phrase I keep hearing is the pulse.
Yeah,
the show had a pulse to it, and you had to go with the pulse.
And in that, you know, we did a little bit of promotional tours together. We got some nice trips, Paris and London and Japan.
Yeah.
And because Fox wasn't paying like a real studio back then because it wasn't an official network. And
right,
was,
right.
So this was one of the ways we could get a little fringe benefit. And the same thing with all the people that were Rupert Murdoch that hired these brilliant women to be the heads of marketing, and they hit benchmarks and surpassed them at half the rate that men would have been paid in that patriarchal world over there at that time.
Yeah.
And we bonded with them, and you know, they put us up in the best hotels, and all, we went to Kyoto and all over the place, but we did a lot of promo. And
yeah, yeah.
We were like pop stars. Like, and it seemed so abstract. The only time in my life where like there were bands and people waiting in the bands and cheering.
The Beatles.
And, yeah, it was like our little Beatle moment.
Right.
And because there's two of us together, we're sort of added to that. And and the only time I ever saw a moment of disarray or disorder in Tokyo, you know, all of Japan, was when they showed us the film of the day they released season two on video in these box sets.
Okay.
And people literally stormed the doors, knocked each other over. They were knocked off of the shelves. They were grabbed, and it was like the, you know, like a Black Friday.
As they Black Friday, yeah.
And that's so not Japanese.
Yeah, and, right.
And, you know, they're always ahead. And so you just knew that this was something else altogether. And I think the cinematic style that Rodney chose, having a long angle lens, yeah, having a handheld camera held by the best handheld cameraman I've ever worked with. I've worked with him before too. Right. Guy. He was like a psychic. He would anticipate the moment before something happened.
Yeah.
The moment something was about to, and he would just move. And he's a big guy. And yeah. Yeah. He just is like one of us. He was in the scene with us. He was so intuitively connected.
Part of it. Yeah. And, yeah.
And that felt like really like high level independent cinema.
Well, and you were in T2, which I remember. I mean, I saw that in the theater opening night, and I remember going, "Whoa, this has now changed so many things." Certainly, the technology and everything else, things we hadn't seen before. But it sounds like you had some of the same experience with 24, because for me, 24 felt like I was watching a movie. I wasn't watching a TV show; I was watching a movie every week, and
yeah,
really, really changed that.
Even like whether it's I did four Alex Cox movies and four Mike Figgis movies, and they were both very cutting edge filmmakers,
right,
in the independent film world. But you know, in addition to T2, there's also Air Force One, which is, I think, we're playing the dirty Secret Service,
yeah,
and hiding out undercover on the plane, you know, trying to, you know, go up against Harrison Ford, one of the biggest mistakes in my life. you're going down with the plane, and not only are you going to get down, you're going to set up a pattern of going down with planes now, man.
He's Han Solo in the Indiana Jones. Come on.
Yeah.
But
I'd done a lot of movies at that point, and I was a little snobby. It was more of a movie guy, and I always sort of dodged committing to a series. And
right.
And Paul Cernow called me up at the end of the first scene, which I'd just been recurring, and said, "Look, Xan, I know you don't like to commit to a series or anything, apparently."
Boy, was he wrong.
But here's my pitch.
Yeah.
You're going to inhale airborne plutonium on the first episode, maybe the second. You got 24 hours to live. That's a season. You want to be a regular for a season? You got a ready-made out. That's very rare.
You're going to die.
And I went, "That sounds fucking crazy." Yeah. I think I'd already told him I didn't want to just keep being that dude that said, "No, Jack." Well, maybe, but this is the last time.
as you twirl the mustache.
And that turned out to be a good idea. Thank goodness I let you do that. You know, it was a little, just being and there was another moment in the first season. Joel and I are still friends to this day. But I'm never confronting good. So am I just being a dick to be a dick? Feeling a little gratuitous right now when I'm being snarky to his wife as she walks up to you like, "Why?" And he goes, "Look, we have one golden rule on this show, and that is never bore." I wasn't planning on boring anybody.
Yeah, right, right.
I just wanted to provide a little reality humanity. Never mind.
Has Joel Sir now given you any hints on what the future of 24 could be?
You know, I haven't talked to him recently. I've got to, because you work with so many people over the years and you gap in your communications, and he's not a social media guy, and I'm a whore. I guess that's what I sort of relied on that to stay in touch with people. but I'll ask him and Howard, because I'm curious to know, because it feels like they did so many seasons. You can't just keep doing more of that. But right. There's something. What would be the zeitgeist equivalent now? And I think if you brought the same kind of topical urgency,
right? Yeah,
and to the domestic situation, the schism in the country, maybe look at that. Maybe the threat of a civil war. That we've all, I think, played that scenario out in over the.
We're Canadian, and we've played that scenario out where we went, "Oh, that's
yeah." Ooh. Yeah.
I mean, I'm across the border from Michigan, and Michigan was the testing ground for what we saw at the beginning of this year. And mm-hmm. I was watching Michigan, and I'm going, why is nobody alarmed about this? This is a 24 plot.
Yes.
Happening.
They were going to bury the governor in Canada, I understand.
That was the concrete plans. Yeah. Again, as a Canadian, I'm looking at that going, why is nobody more alarmed at this? And then, you know, then it culminates in January.
A little bit psychic numb, a little bit.
Yeah, yeah.
And also, I mean, yeah, I mean, you're right. With the state of the world that we're in now, there has been a lot of moments you would think, oh, you know, that you would see that in 24.
Or we've seen it.
Yeah, and I mean, Jack's character still was left alive, too, at the end of Live Another Day, so he's still out there.
And to be clear, we never really know if George Mason's plane may have gone into the ether.
If he did, even if he did go down with it, there's no assurance that he didn't receive the bionic superpowers that many do when exposed to the interface between having inhaled airborne plutonium, being a radiant being to begin with, and then getting further radiated by the nuclear.
I like that. Yeah.
Oh.
I see it. I see an X-Files 24 crossover.
Yes.
There are possibilities. I did do an Outer Limits in two different Twilight Zones.
that's right. You did. That's right.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Another character we really loved of yours, sliding away from 24 for a bit, was your character on The Walking Dead. You played the leader of the Hilltop. What was your experience like on The Walking Dead?
Well, that was they kind of had to talk me into that one, and I liked Joel's pitch better than theirs because really it was on the page, you know, it was a top secret show. They didn't want to reveal anything.
Right.
They were offering me the part, but they were only showing me a couple of sides of a fictional scene that wasn't even in the thing.
Right.
There wasn't a lot to go on. And so I said, okay, I get that this guy's a douche waffle, but I'm not entirely clear on why he is such a douche.
Yeah.
And whether or not there's any other color in the rainbow that you'd be wanting me to play in the course of this. And I said, you know, now I have two children that at some point, you know, having had children later, I'm a realist, but at some point I'll be gone and I want them to flip through the channels and see daddy as something other than a shitheel. And
right.
And I told that to him. I said, well, here's the thing. Yeah, you're right. No, he's unctuous. There's no denying that. Yeah. But I think he's funny. And we want him to be funny, and and we've got this weird thing that we have a relationship that there's a pop culture junkie in me, regardless of all the great films that you've been involved with. The pop culture junkie in me just can't help but want to see a face off between George Mason and Trevor of Grand Theft Auto.
So these are clearly fans of 24 that said.
And I don't know if you know Stephen Ogg, but he was the guy that played the prototype of Trevor on Grand Theft Auto. And,
right.
And Scott, you know, I have to say to his credit, was an incredible matchmaker, just like Joel was unwittingly. Because Stephen Ogg and I had a massive bromance during the filming of The Walking Dead. Even though our characters were antagonistic, they very much enjoyed a very high level of witty banter in their squirm, you know, his dominating and my squirming. And it's very rare that I have a guy that much bigger than me so that I can play the guy that's nervously squirming.
There's a lot of nervous squirming.
A lot of nervous squirming went on in the midst of my douche waffling. And, you know, what was amazing, they actually developed a camera, a whole camera mode for us whenever the Simon and Gregory characters were together, that because they knew that we were going to be doing it so differently in every take because we were going to be playing the moment together because we were just hitting it off and we would go off, we would rehearse and we would have the line so nailed down that we could, because they liked the word perfect as opposed to 24 where literally I did a tremendous amount of ghostly writing. This, there's not a syllable changes. And so that you aren't in your head thinking about the syllables, he and I would get together and we would rock that shit. We were enjoying each other's company so much and discovering places in Atlanta to hang out and just go over lunch. And we showed up to set and we were ready to rock and roll, but we didn't want it to get flat ever. And we instinctively have the same actor's impulse, which is, this moment is never going to be the same. So I'm listening to everything you're saying in this moment. I'm reacting in this moment. But if you do something differently, I'm going to react differently. And if I did something differently, he would react differently. And so no two takes would ever match. So they had to have two long angle lenses shooting both of us at the same time.
Wow. Another
shot.
I got to go back and watch those again. I have to go back and watch those scenes again.
They were dead cool, fun to play. And everybody on that show, Andy Lincoln, is, I will just never stop singing his praises as a gentleman, a scholar, and a team captain. You know, Kiefer had this kind of wonderful everyman spirit for the crew. He had a great way of watching out for the crew, taking great care of them. And I think that's one of the reasons that show is the success it was, and that the crew stayed in there and they were as much a part of that process as anything. But Andrew had this thing about just any time, whether it was like a person playing a bit part, he'd bring them under the wing and gave the sense that so few, number one on the call sheets, do about their fellow actors, that we're all pulling on the same end of the rope.
Right.
And we're pulling to keep the audience in. And that's the... and that you'll do anything and everything in service of that together, rather than, you know, I've worked on so many shows where there were divas and people that don't get how much the magic is made up of that.
The connections. Yeah. I mean, and he was the one that started that show, like literally just him, you know, waking up in the hospital bed and the whole thing. And to take on that role and to become
season six, late. end of season six when I came on, man, that son of a bitch was still so 100% committed. And like, here's another example. It's rare. I have to come into the show and I have to own it. I run Hilltop.
Right.
And my opening line, they're like, Jesus, you're back.
Yeah.
Company. And, you know, and I see them and they're just this filthy, bedraggled bunch of people in my very clean home.
Right.
And not pleased. And they've all got these, you know, weapons and stuff like that. But I'm the king of the roost here. And so I go right up and I get into Andy's grill and say, so Jesus will show you where you can go get cleaned up. And then I'll meet you back down here in about 20 minutes. And he goes, we're good. And Jesus will show you where you can go get cleaned up. I did it in the first rehearsal that way. I just got right up in his grill.
Right.
You know, I went back into the room because I have to make my grand entrance. So I went back into the room and I waited for the director coming. Goes, you can't get that close to him. Pre-COVID, you can't get as close as we wanted. Most guys that are playing the macho center of a show,
right?
When every movie, there's a sense of boundary, and they're almost like an invisible force field that's part of their star magic or something. Mm-hmm. And you can't cross that line. And sometimes I will do it in the very first rehearsal just to show that it can be done,
right?
So that the directors, before they said, no, you can't do that. And then they'll always meet a little bit in the back of their minds, and so will the actor. But even though they'll choose something that ends up being more flattering to them or their,
right.
You know, no, nobody would get that close. His head would be rolling down the, you know, whatever it is that they'll say. And even if you're the one holding the guns on somebody in a Western, and their hands are in the air, you still have to be scared of them instead of them scared of you. You know, it's like unspoken.
The more you talk about it, the more I realize you were the leader that actually was enjoying themselves, because you had the governor, you had, you know, everything up leading up to, nobody was having fun, right? Or nobody's portraying that I like this. I mean, these are my people.
Life.
Yeah.
They're hard times. We still got to have a good time. So,
exactly.
So I want the director to come in and say, yeah, look, here's the thing. You haven't been, this show's been going on for 6 years. This is, and you can't get that close to Andy. And instead, Andy busts through the door. Like in a couple of seconds, I'm sitting there trying to gather myself. And yeah. He comes in and he runs over to me, lifts me off the ground, spins me in three circles. And goes, I'm so glad you're doing this show. Oh, my God. And like,
well, after 6 years, you're a breath of fresh air.
Well, and that's literally what Scott said when talking about bringing me on the show, is that the show had a certain thing, and he said, look, I almost want to feel like we're in a different show when you come on. I want to open the window and let it, and I said, so let's open the window and let a nice, cool, and sort of weirdly northwestern breeze blow through, and let's feel like something strange is happening.
Just
now in a different world. And so we had fun, and then, you know, it ran its course, and so many things that got involved in why it went the way it did. But I always knew I was going to get hung. That's the other reason why I did it, because on my death reel, I didn't have any hangings.
check.
Plane explosions or 30-floor falls. Like, you know, you needed to mix it up.
Yeah.
That's not the reel you want your kids to see, though. probably not the reel, you know, you want
to. They get used to seeing Daddy die.
Oh, that's great. I you know what I'm watching tonight, because I got to go back and rewatch those episodes, which are all in my set upstairs. But yeah, those I didn't even dawn on me until you were talking that you were the one that brought the fun to the apocalypse, which is amazing.
It was some fun. We did have some fun. And Scott had told me, look, I used to be a comedy writer at one point. I kind of missed the funny. I'm kind of hoping you're going to bring some. But it was a delicate thing, because you don't want to, because so people are such hardcore addicts of that show. You don't want it to be their reality.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
So it was a nightmare that you could fall off on either side of. because you got to keep the dramatic tension taut all the time.
Right.
But that to me feeds humor, especially if you find a way to make this guy like he's such a clueless dick. Yeah, he doesn't get how funny what a jackass he is.
Yeah.
He's just going to walk on his own.
Do you think, would you think Rick Grimes and Jack Bauer have similar qualities to each other?
Yeah, oh, for sure. I mean, they're like, even though, you know, Cooper is Canadian and Andy is British, they're all American. The characters they created were these all-American cowboys. They were both like the guy in the Western that's the lawman who's willing to deal with this uncivilized this wild frontier.
A new
frontier, because in both cases with 24 under the terrorist threat. And the zombie apocalypse, these are circumstances people haven't faced before, so they hearken to the American West, and every man's on their own. It's a lawless land, and new rules, and we need a new cowboy to roll in and with a badge on and hold up justice, even at whatever it takes. Yeah.
Yeah, to be literally the sheriff.
And I honestly, when I was making up the character and Scott and I were having a ball going back and forth, it's like, okay, a little of this, a little of that. I thought about Westerns a lot. I wanted it to be the one that made almost a more obvious nod to that, but I didn't want it to be too obvious. So I incorporated a lot of the guy with Preston from Music Man. And that huckster, and I wanted to incorporate a little bit of the guy, the Wizard of Oz, when he's playing the sort of charlatan that she meets on the road, and a little bit of the professor from Lost in Space, who's very rarely are people that are as arrogant as that, as funny as he was, and. So there was some mix in all of those.
Well, I'm going to say that, I mean, you just brought up Dr. Smith. We meet George in the first season, and we're trained not to like him. I mean, you get knocked out right at the beginning, right? So we're trained not to like you. Whatever Jack says, you just, I wrote down in my notes, the dad who has to be the dad, but really we're going to give you the ice cream later, but I've still got to play the dad as far as everybody else needs to. But we're conditioned over like a full season to go, yeah, what's that guy? Yeah, which is very convincing, right? But then by the time you have your heroic sacrifice, I mean, that was, you were the first, I think the real first heroic sacrifice of
yes,
the series.
Yes, was George, where yes.
Where you gave your life for that. And by that point, the audience is going, oh, he's not going to do it, is he? He's not going to do it. And to go from, we don't like that guy to, well, that guy's not good. We need him. We need him, right? That's a great transformation.
I wasn't too fond of George Mason early on in season one.
Are you telling him right here?
No, he's but right here. I'm saying I loved him, as the season one went on, and I loved him even more in season two. Actually, one of my favorite lines from season two is when you guys bring back Jack Bauer in the first episode of season two from, I guess, from retirement, sort of.
Exile.
Yeah.
And I think it was the first or second episode, and he goes, I'm going to need a hacksaw. That was epic.
That was unlike any other TV I'd ever seen.
And I think that was definitely an improvised line where, oh my God, was he the guy's head off?
Yeah, because he shot him point blank.
And I remember when we were watching it in real time, your heroic sacrifice happened, and then there was like a 3 or 4 week gap where we're speculating. Maybe he didn't do it. Maybe you know, he was able to take a parachute or something. And you know, that was a long 4 weeks trying to find out what happened to George.
Yeah.
We missed you already.
It's interesting how it worked, because you know, I did my own makeup for the radiation effects, and I've been a makeup guy from all the way back. That's one of the reasons I was trying to fly under the radar. I never really wanted to get pegged and pinned down to one guy, so I could transform the way I looked and be something that the audience could believe. But you know, that's just something I liked when I was a kid, when actors were able to do that, disguise themselves from one film to the next. And when you do a series, you're going to be, there's no way that you're playing the same guy over and over, and you go in their homes once a week. But I brought some skills that I'd had from being in the theater as a kid that I'd started and had been honed and perfected working with great film makeup artists along the way and getting close friends and getting the trade secrets. So I had it measured out for the whole season, which I thought was just a brilliant twist, the idea that he was going to die over the course of the season and have an opportunity to redeem himself and make up as a guy would to try and make up for a life misspent. Because it's not until mortality, it's on your shoulder, that you have an awakening of conscience sometimes. Mm-hmm. Because as long as you're thinking you're going to go on forever, but that ticking,
all of a sudden, it's right there.
Oh, shit, I'm going to meet my maker, man. And
the clock is actually ticking for you.
Totally. And then you're going to leave people there. And what are they going to remember you for? You're suddenly thinking about that. Yeah. I got a hold of that fucking kid. I got that son out there. Yeah. And then, different things,
Was there a point in time where your character, where it could have gone another way, where you didn't die and you could have stayed on the show past season two? Was that ever an option for you?
There was no. That was how the season two was presented, and that's what made it appealing to me. Because I did see him otherwise being a device that I've seen on other shows where it's just the same time, because they've always got to have the hero is the one who comes up with a great idea. It's never come up with a great idea. You're always the one shooting down the great idea and then endivolating and going, oh, well, okay, you can do the great idea. And then, look, you were right. You did the great idea. And it's just not a rewarding thing to keep doing.
You've seen it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So I didn't want to do that. And they knew that. And so they thought of something.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woo-hooer, a hand clapper, a high-fiver? I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.
And just as my irony and the sardonic humor and the gravitas thing inspired them, that inspired them to think outside the box. And they came up with that as an offer. And I was like, yeah, because the audience wanted to see the guy back in the show. And so it was just a perfect combination. And it just gave a pathos to every scene that the guy played. And so I had it mapped out because I'd done all my research. I'd talked to all my top specialists, what materials to use. And, you know, to find out what actually happens when you're exposed to airborne plutonium and how the lesions start to burst surface and how the skin starts
mapping it out. Yeah.
Dry out. At what point am I going to lose a limb or drop an ear? I had to figure this out. And so I'm going in at around episode, I don't know, maybe it was 13. And I go up to Howard Gordon, who we became good friends again. So Howard, do we know, is it going to be like the end or when? I'm just trying to map my progression.
Yeah.
So I pace this thing, right? When I'm going to meet my maker. And he said, that would be a Joel question, and a strange, a nervous quality that I was not accustomed to seeing in his eyes.
Right.
And I walked into, actually, Joel's in right now. If you want to see him. And I walked in thinking, it's weird. Yeah, go talk to Joel now. And he's leaning back and goes, 15, but you're going to love it. And it was like, not 22, not 20. 15?
15, I got two more?
know I said I wanted to go, but I didn't want to go back. Now, here's the thing. We got that bomb. It's killing us. It's killing us. It's going to kill the show. It's so fucking boring at this point. The bomb. It's two birds, one stone, but it's going to be fucking great TV.
And it was.
It was.
It lived up to it.
Yeah,
it had us all on the edge of our seat.
Yeah, and the twist too at the end of season one when we found out Nina Myers was the
changed
traitor.
TV was done.
You know, she was a sweet, innocent, good girl from the Midwest, and I was the shit. If anything, I'd be honest, like,
it's gonna be
you. Them all, right? You're gonna be like, you'll switcheroo, but the Berklers do it again.
Exactly. We did. We got you again.
So we became an official evil team,
and started
to spawn.
Well, I mean, I call it veer left. Everything you've described, you know, I don't want to do the straight path that everybody's done. I want to veer left from this scenario. And I was on Clubhouse. I happened to veer left into your room where you were doing readings, and it was amazing listening to plays being read. It veered left as far as everything else I'd seen on Clubhouse, and it was like a nice. Do you want to talk about that? That was a really, really nice place to be.
There's been a couple of these spontaneous things that I had actually started doing with various people during the pandemic, doing a few things that could be sent out to nursing homes and to schools and stuff like that, YouTube stuff and different groups on Zoom, doing readings and the Clubhouse format. Somebody had encouraged me to get involved, and then he has a room and where he has a couple of different ones where he does different things, and we bounced some ideas around. So ended up doing something along that line, because we both like language and we miss hearing great literature. A lot of times when you're an actor, you end up just reading scripts all the time and you don't get to the books that you want to get to. And so if you set it up for yourself as part of your discipline as an actor, that you're going to read a play or you're going to read certain works of literature on a fairly regular basis, it really is something good just because it keeps another part of your brain active. And
absolutely.
The part with the writer that needs to come up with the dialogue that's missing here and there, or to come up with a whole script with friends and so forth. We started doing that there, and it's just something. And I've mentioned to you, I've sort of become addicted to great language and any opportunity. And I have to create those opportunities a lot of times because you don't get to experience it otherwise. But I want to do more of that on there.
It seems like at a time when the physical can't happen, right? The physical meeting and all that kind of stuff. But you found a way to transcend that. I mean, certainly, the last year has for me, it slowed me down and kind of put away a lot of the extraneous stuff that was the treadmill, as you said earlier, right?
Yeah, and it's a reset. Yeah. I mean, a lot of people have found that. And it's any time, you're thrown off your, the law of momentum and the direction that things progress in, and you suddenly have an interruption, you can take stock. And this has been a huge reset for people, like, okay, what have we gained from this? And what can we do now before we just go back to the business as usual? What do we want to incorporate in our lives? How do we ask ourselves what do we really want to do? What do we really miss? What do we really want? And to me, higher levels of creativity are always calling. And new ways of telling stories. Because I think we get trapped in, this is how the, and 24 is a great example. They broke a model and created something really vital and exciting in the process. And I think the more you can do that as creatives and not just keep doing the same old shit.
Exactly.
Procedural. Yeah. Well,
I would recommend everybody find what you're doing online because it is, refreshing was the only way I could describe it, to hear some of the plays.
Thanks. You know, Sarah and I bought a farm in Maine 7 years ago and a nice little stretch of land, an old dairy farm from the 1820s, Wadsworth, and a great deal of history in the bones of the place. And we've been renovating it since we fell in love. We'd come there every summer with the kids, and couldn't bear to go back to LA in August because it was just the harvest was coming in, the leaves were about to turn, and the air was getting crisp. And we go back to the blazing heat and get our kids playing soccer on the tarmac.
Great.
And you know, back into school in August in LA, and it was just like when the heat was starting to kick in, and we were up in the hills. It just seemed that the traffic was getting heavier, the heat was growing higher, and fires were like about to go off, and they're about to burst. And we, Sarah, never, you know, she'd moved to New York from New York, having left New York, and was never a big fan of LA. I'd been there a lot longer. I developed a real close community of creatives and friends, and and there was something about it that I loved, but I was ready. I was ready because it had been long enough, and I missed the seasons. So we ended up in Maine for summers, and then we couldn't bear to go back, so we ended up finding a place on the water, on the bay here, and outside of Portland, and it's so beautiful, and the kids have a normal childhood where they can ride their bikes and go visit their friends, and you're not paranoid about them getting taken to another country. You know, it's just a different thing. And creatively, I really want, I have so many great friends that are so talented, and they're successful, but they're on a kind of treadmill like we were, where you have to keep, now you have to support all these private schools, and you have to do this, and you have to do that in order to stay in the, and you're working all the time just to sustain the lifestyle. And so, getting off the treadmill and offering the opportunity to others, at least for the summer, have like summer camp for our grown-up friends and their creative offspring of all ages, and have a space where people can come and try out new ideas, try different things, be able to film like little video treatments of different ideas, have different groups come over different weeks. And that's the goal. And we're working on getting film tax incentives for film brought to the state, and looking pretty good on that front.
Excellent.
First for Maine, and there's just such great storytelling that can be told here, because there's just something magical about the quality of light, about the historic architecture, and the deep woods and mountains and rivers and oceans. We've got it all here, like California, but you know, it's a seasonal thing, but it can look amazing in snow. And so, yeah, we're excited to bring stuff. And so I'm going to be starting on Clubhouse, a group called the Maine Event, and Maine with an E at the end. And, you just start to gather some creative colleagues, and we'll be brainstorming, and we'll be reading material, and we'll be doing all kinds of things. And part of that is just, you know, that was my route. When I left New York as a virtual kid, brought out to LA by an agent, I told all my friends that thought I was selling out from the theater in New York, you know, and I said, look, I'm just going there long enough to roll up a stake, make enough money, and come back and buy a farm, and we'll have farm freedom, kid. And it took me a couple of decades longer than I anticipated, but I'm going to do it. And
it's all part of the plan.
It's happening.
All part of the plan. Yeah, yeah. No, that's exciting. And did you have a connection to Maine before?
I'd come up in the summer. Maybe be my favorite memory, whenever I stop along the course of my life and say, what's your favorite moment? My father in a rowboat, I'll get teary, just going across a little island. It was just everything about the place is so beautiful. It's just like, hey, I'm so happy right now. It's like, you're happy.
I've got Bermuda in my background. That's where my dad was from. And when I go there, my dad has been gone about 5 years, but when I go there, people are like, you're Rodney's son, aren't you? And that there's no pride like that. Like to,
You carry that happy place in your heart to get you through other moments. It's not like it's that one thing, but there's always been a sense of New England for me. I thought I'd end up in Vermont for some reason, because I had a lot of places in Vermont. I had a lot of friends had places with their families that we'd go up in the fall. It's just, that was always the thing in LA. When autumn would come, it would break my heart, and then when the snow would be falling, I'd be like missing it. And I love the balmy breezes and the pretty weather all the time, but I always long to return to, you know, you do. I don't know. Did you grow up in Bermuda?
I know. I grew up in Windsor and London, with two okay. London, Ontario, about 2 hours away.
And you stayed there. Did you ever spend any time away from that world for a long period of time?
Yeah, I did. I did, and I would spend summers in Bermuda when I was a kid, and that is what sticks with me.
It makes me
need to go back there. And when I took my wife there for the first time, it was a thrill because that was the first time I'd actually done the touristy stuff there, because I was family. But then I got to do the touristy stuff and enjoy it in a whole different way. So.
Yeah, you know that's one of the fun things about being an actor. I'll just sideline. Some people don't think about it, that you get to travel all over the world. I'll always be so grateful to LA for sending me around the world many times, because that's really what a lot of my decisions were predicated on.
Sure.
Not becoming famous or becoming rich as much as having these rich life experiences. And my mother sort of disdained the idea of my becoming an actor. She thought I was going to do something a little more noble, like perhaps be in the diplomatic services or ambassadorial services. And although now that's considered the deep state, suddenly if they're not.
The rules have changed.
But I think that one of the reasons why I've been drawn to a lot of political intrigue over the years is because that always was the path not taken. And I did choose a lot of jobs in foreign countries. And I did end up, the embassy would always invite you because you're with the movie company. Everybody wants a little Hollywood in the house. When you're in a country, they want more films to come to that country. And so they wine and dine you at the embassy, and you kind of meet the deputy ambassadors, the junior diplomats, and you exchange numbers, and you figure out who the spies are. Oh, the UPS guy, I get it. So you get to go to the embassy bar on occasion, and that's just all interesting. And you get to talk to these guys, and then, you know, because I'm an artist and I paint and sculpt and I draw whenever I'm on location. Whenever I have a day off, I'll go. It's my excuse to study people, so I'll go down to the art, and usually the art supply store would be near the university or whatever, and you'd be drawing people in a cafe, and some cinephile would come up and go, "Pardon me, what you in possibly? Possibly what in movie?" And, and the next thing you know, you're gaining entree into their world. You're not there as a tourist. You're there because you're living there for that 2-3 months, and you're working there with people. And so you got the crew, that's a lot of whom are from wherever you're shooting. And then you've got the actors that are from wherever, all over, a lot of the international films I worked on. But you're doing recon when you're the bad guy. You're not in there every day doing good guy stuff, you know. So you get to do reconnaissance and find out where the stuff is going down in the local places. And you get to bring people out on the weekends. This is a cool place. You get invited to a big party.
You get to see the real places.
Go to a wedding. Yeah, you know, you just go, and then people are like, yeah, but Hollywood, come to a wedding. Yeah, sure. It's cool. Next thing you know, you're the wedding.
I get the impression you choose your own adventure.
Yeah, but you sort of also learn that you can put together the head of the student union with the deputy ambassador, the deputy diplomat, and you don't have to cut through 3 years of red tape to do it. You can say, you know, that wood fire burning, that wood burning pizza joint on that cobblestone street.
Yeah,
that one. Okay. What are you doing next Friday? And you surprise them by you introduce people that you know should be talking.
Sure. Wow.
And suddenly you just sit back and just watch. And I've had a lot of diplomats tell me it would have taken 4 years to do what you did in the past. And so I feel like I pulled through my
You clearly take joy in connecting people that should be talking and making that happen.
I actually have a really corny little thing that I say where I can do it because I want to be a con. And the ego doesn't have to take any credit. You can just sit back and watch other people do it. And it's about watching, the joy of watching people connect. And I feel that way about producing, and what I want to do in the next phase of my life is now putting together all the magical people that I've gotten, been fortunate enough to work with in all different capacities, seeing what happens when they get in the room or get on a farm.
That's awesome.
June 14th, Republic of Sarah. I'll just leave with that.
Yes, yeah, please. Sorry, Republic of Sarah, June 14th.
I don't enter until two episodes in, so bear with it, but there are some really cool things happening because it takes place on a border town in New Hampshire, between Canada and the States, and the maps were drawn in the 1850s for it to be Canadian territory, and later in the 1860s, it's American, and it goes on being American until, for reasons that will be discovered when you watch the show, it becomes its own republic.
Sounds well, awesome. And which network is that?
CW.
CW, yes. Awesome. Okay.
Well, we'll be watching, and we're looking forward to it.
I really applaud the CW for doing a brave departure, just like Fox when they did 24. I think it's going to be looking forward to it.
We're excited, too.
We'll make sure we link to it. Great
job, guys.
Thank you so much. And this has been amazing.
Yes, thank you
for taking the time.
Typical barrister.